Okay, so this week is Parshat Emor. I was actually at an amazing conference until last night for the OU Women's Initiative on Leadership. So I was really excited because there's a shiur that I really love that I give that I had not yet given within our Parsha shiur, and it happened to line up with the Parsha. You'll see it's a little bit, it's not a stretch because it's definitely in the Parsha, but it's we're only going to touch a little bit on the Parsha and then expand on that. And this is one of my favorite things to talk about. And I was looking through all of my Parsha Shirim and realized I'd never spoken about it. So I'm really excited. And I added some things to it also because I recently gave it over to my Tikva class, which is a special class we have here at Kohelet that I co-teach with the English teacher. And we look at secular and Jewish philosophical themes in the English literature we're reading. So this was from To Kill a Mockingbird, where we talked about fate and destiny. So I'm really excited. I don't think I said the date. It is Wednesday, May 3rd, Yud Bet Iyar, which is the Hebrew birthday of both my youngest son and my first daughter-in-law. And it is the 27th day of the Omer. Okay, so we're going to begin with this quotation from Isaiah Berlin, not the singer of the author, not the songwriter, but the philosopher from England. And he wrote about this notion of positive liberty. So this is from Wikipedia, it's just a summary, simplistic summary of his writings on liberty. So positive liberty is the possession of the power and resources to act in the context of the structural limitations of the broader society, which impacts a person's ability to act, as opposed to negative liberty, which is freedom from external restraint on one's action. And this, you can see, was written in 1969. And so this idea of positive liberty is a freedom to, when you have the freedom to choose your structure that you are agreeing to live within, versus negative liberty or freedom from, which is there are no restraints placed on you at all. And I think we're going to see that already in the 1950s, maybe Rabbi Soloveitchik had a different, obviously more Jewish view of this philosophy. I don't know if anybody, I'm sure somebody has, I just haven't read it because I am not an expert in Rav Soloveitchik or his influences or everything that influenced his writing. But I wonder if anybody ever compared Rav Soloveitchik's writings to anything in Isaiah Berlin and this notion of liberty. And we'll see when we get to it towards the end. So we're going to look at one pasuk here. And this is in Perek Chaf Gimel, which was the same perek that I focused on last year when we talked about the random pasuk of the agricultural laws in the middle of all the holidays. And I told you then, and I'll tell you again, that you can remember which chapter in Vayikra has all the holidays because it's Perek Chaf Gimel, which is Chag spelt the wrong way. Holiday, Chet Gimel. Okay, so here, this is Pasuk Lamed Vav. So it already told us about Pesach, the counting of the Omer, and then Shavuot. And then it has the agricultural laws, and then it goes on to Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Shavuot. So this is in the middle of the discussion, I mean, not Shavuot, Sukkot. So this is in the middle of the discussion about Sukkot. Shivat Yamim Takrivu Isha. Sorry. Isha Lasham Bayom Hashmini Mikra Kodesh Yelacham Behikravtem Isha Lasham Atzerati. Komalacha Davada Lotasu. So 7 days you shall bring a fire offering to the Lord. This is in the middle of the discussion of Sukkot. So it already told us about the Yom Tov, the first day, and the Korbanot. And then for a 7-day period, you shall bring a fire offering to the Lord. On the 8th day, it shall be a holy occasion for you, and you shall bring a fire offering to the Lord. It is a day of detention. I don't know what detention means either. But Atzeret means stopping. And we call the last day of Sukkot Shmini Atzeret. In America, we also have Simchat Torah. But even on Simchat Torah, if you've benched or davened, you notice that it's Shmini Chag HaAtzeret, that it's not called Simchat Torah in Galut. That's a recent invention. And it's called Atzeret. And you're not allowed to do any work or labor on that last day of Sukkot. So the Ramban there has something very interesting that he goes into. So we'll just do the English. He commanded 7 days on the festival of Matzot, so Pesach, which is called Chag HaMatzot here, with holiness before them and after them. That's the first day and the last day that are Yom Tov, since they are all holy and amongst them is the Lord. And he counted from it 49 days, 7 weeks, like the days of yore, and he sanctified the eighth, like the eighth day of the festival Sukkot. And the days that are counted between them are like the intermediate days of the festival. I'm just going to go into the Hebrew. So he counted 49 days, 7 weeks, and he sanctified the eighth. So day 50 is the beginning of the eighth week. It wasn't so clear in the English. So you have Sukkot of 8 days, the eighth day of sanctify, and then you have the time period in between Pesach and Shavuot, where Shavuot, in terms of the counting, day 50 is the beginning of the eighth week. It's 7 complete weeks, and then Shavuot starts. So the Ramban is making this connection between Sukkot, where you have Sukkot is day one. We call the whole holiday Sukkot, but really it's two different holidays, as I mentioned before, in the benching and the davening. It's Sukkot and Shmini Chag HaAtzeret. And he is making this comparison, so too is Pesach and Shavuot. And that's why it's a good way to remember. On Sukkot, when you light candles or when you say Kiddush, you say Shehecheyanu on both the first days and the last days, because it's a new holiday. Pesach, it's the same holiday. We don't say Shehecheyanu on the last days of Pesach. It's always confusing at that time. There's always a question, do we say it? So this is a good way to remember. It's not a new holiday. It's the same holiday. And we have this counting, which the Ramban is saying, V'hayamin esfarim bintayim, these days of counting in between Pesach and Shavuot are like Chol HaMoed, between the first, the same way it is on Sukkot, between the first day and the last day. And it is the day of the giving of the Torah, on which he showed them his great fire. And therefore, in every place, our rabbis, may their memory be blessed, called the festival of weeks, Shavuot, Atzeret, just like, and you can see that in the Hebrew here, Chag HaShavuot, Atzeret. Okay? So it's not called Atzeret in the Chumash at all. It starts to be called that by the rabbis. And it's a question, why are the rabbis calling Shavuot Atzeret when there's already a holiday, Shmini Chag HaAtzeret, the last day of Sukkot, that's called Atzeret? And here's your answer. It's similar. It's a similar structure. And it's a shame that people who aren't plugged in to the Jewish calendar and to observant Judaism, that they think there's Passover and then it's end. So as you'll see, we're going to go through, I'm going to suggest that Passover is the freedom from. We were released from slavery. We have negative liberty, as Isaiah Berlin would say, but we don't have any direction. You need to keep counting, and you need to get to the giving of the Torah to get that positive liberty, the freedom too. And that's what the Shir is going to be about. So that's why I said it was a little stretch, but it is right there in the Parsha, in the Ramban, in how he does that. Okay, so now we're going to see some sources. The Sfas Emes, B'inyan ma shenikra chag ha-shavot atzeret. So he's asking the question, why do the rabbis call Shavuot atzeret? B'divrei chachamim, in the words of our wise ones, the rabbis. D'chtiv Torah tziva lanu Moshe, because it says, Moshe commanded the Torah to us. Kihilat Yaakov is a congregation of Yaakov. Everyone knows that line. It's supposed to be the first thing you teach your kids. Torah, tziva lanu Moshe. And then Morasha Kihilat Yaakov. It's an inheritance for the congregation of Yaakov. V'kachu b'mei ha-sfira. And thus it is during the time of counting the Omer. Na'asin b'nei Yisrael kihila echat. We, B'nai Israel, become one community. B'zochin achar kach l'Torah. And that's why we merit the Torah, b'Shavuot, on Shavuot. Kasher Amar, this is a quotation from his father, Ki yamei sfirat ha'omer hu al shem kibbutz klalot B'nai Israel. It's the counting of the Omer is because it's the gathering of the general population of B'nai Israel. V'zeh yamitzkayam b'hakravat ha'omer. And this would come to be with the offering of the Omer, the sheaf of barley that was brought every day at this time. Ukshayu b'nei Yisrael b'shleimut hara'ui. And when Israel was at this completion, this worthy completion, perfection of alata, but now, sha'anu b'madrega p'chota, now that we're at a lower level, tzrichin al kol panim l'kabel zahit klalalut ayudei Torah. All the more so do we need to have this sense of belonging, of community, by way of the Torah. Ki gam nichlal b'pasuk she'ayudei ha-Torah morasha kihilat Yaakov. Because that's Torah tzivalanu Moshe. Moshe commanded us the Torah. Morasha kihilat Yaakov. It's an inheritance for the congregation of Yaakov. Ve'atzeret, so another definition of atzeret in Onklus, in the Aramaic translation, is knufya, is a gathering. L'chein karuhu chazal atzeret. And that's why our rabbis called Shavuot this gathering, because we're gathering around the Torah. So Shmini Chag HaAtzeret, it's a very famous Rashi Midrash that says that Sukkot is the nation for all the nations, and that's why there's a total of 70 sacrifices representing the 70 nations, and in the world, and when Mashiach comes, they'll also observe Sukkot in some way. And then Shmini Chag HaAtzeret is like when the king has his party for all of his people. Everybody comes for a whole week. And then he doesn't want to take leave of his closest friends, and he asks them to stay one more day. And that's what Shmini Chag HaAtzeret is. So it's a special day between us and Hashem, the gathering. And the Sfasem is here saying that it's a similar type of gathering in honor of the Torah and coming and bringing together all of Bnei Yisrael for receiving the Torah. And that's what we're working on, he's implying, from Pesach until Shavuot, to that Atzeret, that gathering that we have in the receiving of the Torah. Okay, so the Mate Moshe. Oh, I don't have any biographies for you. I think after the story, he's actually on the sheet, but just not here. So he first quotes the Ramban. This is Dine Shavuot, the laws of Shavuot. And then he goes on and say, "V'afshar shelezev ramza haTorah lomar Shabbatot tmimot." Maybe this is what the Torah is hinting at when it says, "Complete weeks, seven complete weeks." So, Shavuot, the way that this plays out today is, sometimes in the summer, especially, communities will start Shabbat early. Like in our community, at certain minyanim are only 7 p.m. They never go later than that, even though Shabbos actually starts later. Shavuot, because it has to be seven complete weeks, you can't bring in Shavuot early. So the minyan is very late, going to be on that Thursday night when Shavuot starts. So it has to be seven complete weeks. Shamru shehu milashon shvita. So Shabbat comes from the word shvita, which means to cease. V'nagu mikan shelo lasot hanashim melacha v'leilot hasfira. So I had never heard of this before. This wasn't really relevant to my share, but I included it because I couldn't believe it, that there was a minhag, apparently, that the women didn't do work on the nights during the evening of the counting of the Omer. So, I don't know, ladies, take some time off tonight until Shavuot. Shehu kmo remez she'aviru cholo shel moed. Oh, it was relevant, because this is a hint that it's like Chol HaMoed. And in Chol HaMoed, certain melachot are restricted, that you're not supposed to do. We can do a lot of things, but certain things are really supposed to be restricted. And because of this, Pesach wasn't sanctified. The last day of Pesach wasn't sanctified with a separate korban, mishar yamim, from the rest of the days. Ve'en bo halal gemor ad yom ha-chamishim. This is so beautiful. Because I'm really excited about this, because I had this conference, I didn't review this the way I usually do. So it's like I'm reading it for the first time now as well. So also, if you noticed, on Pesach, the first 2 days of Pesach, in Israel it's just the first day, we say the full Hallel. But all the rest of the days of Pesach, including the last day, which is Yom Tov, we only say what's called Chatzi Hallel, the half Hallel, which is missing two whole sections of Hallel, and it's the same one we say on Rosh Chodesh. So even when it was Rosh Chodesh Iyar, and when it'll be Rosh Chodesh Sivan, we're still saying that incomplete Hallel. And the next time after the first days of Pesach that we'll say a full Hallel will be Shavuot. So it's just another way to see the connection. She'ikar kedushat hayom hu inyan hachamishim. The main aspect of the holiness of the day is in the number 50, Nun. U'mita'am zeh, gam kein lo amar b'shishi b'sivan, ta'aseh chag ha-shavuot, kamo she-zachar b'kol sha'ar ha-moadim. And for this reason also, it doesn't give us the date of Shavuot. It's never mentioned in the Torah. It doesn't say, on the 6th of Sivan, you will celebrate the holiday of Shavuot, like it says for all the other holidays. Ela she'asato ha-Torah snif l'chag ha-Pesach. So he's saying that the Torah, in not giving its date and simply making it dependent on the start of Pesach and that you count these 7 complete weeks, he's saying that the Torah is making it a branch of Pesach, an extended branch of Pesach. D'ktiv v'chaga Pesach usfartzam lachem mimacharat ha-shvat. It includes in the description of the holiday of Pesach, and you should count them from the day after Shabbat. And there's a whole discussion. It's a big machloket, especially famous between B'nai Israel, the Jews, and the Karaites, who took everything literally, of what does this mean, the day after Shabbat. So the Karaites say the day after Shabbos, Saturday, whereas we have always understood it as the day after the day of rest, meaning the first day of Pesach. And that's why we start counting the Omer on the second day of Pesach, which in Galut for us is still a day of rest, but in Israel it's no longer, it's Chol Moed. So that's a big discussion, and that's how Shavuot is completely connected to Pesach, because in Pesach we go directly into this flow of starting to count the Omer that leads us to Shavuot, and it doesn't give us the date. It's all dependent on Pesach. Ad memacharat ha-Shabbat ha-Shvi'it, until the day after the 7th week, to sapru nun yom v'hikravtem. You should count 50 days and then bring the sacrifices. Klomar b'yom ha-nun, that is to say on the 50th day, takriva korban, you should bring a korban, v'lo tesapru, and you don't count on that 50th day on Shavuot. Nitber mikol zeh shechag ha-Shavuot nikra atzeret. And we understand from all this, that's why Shavuot is called atzeret, which means stop, because we've stopped the count that we started at Pesach, and that's how it's all connected. So we saw before from the Sfat Emet that atzeret had this definition of assembly, and now we're seeing from the Matei Moshe that atzeret has this notion of ceasing. We're ceasing the count that we started Pesach, and that's how it's connected. Whereas the Sfat Emet, the connection was that we begin this turning towards assembly of coming together of Bnei Yisrael in order to receive the Torah. Okay, so now I want to switch to this idea of freedom from and freedom to, and what's the origination of it. So it's from the Brit Bein HaBetarim, which is a covenant between the parts, which is the first covenant, the first Brit that Hashem makes with Avraham. So the pasuk says, Vayotzei oto achutza. He took him outside, which is strange in and of itself. From where to where? We didn't know where he took him from. We just know he's outside. Vayomer, and he said, notice if, as we read this, or you can even look at the English, pretend, my mother doesn't have to pretend, that you are an English teacher, okay? And you're reading this, and tell me how you would edit it if a student handed you this paper, this sentence. So he, with a capital H, said, Habetna hashamayma, look at the heavens. We're going to see that this word look in Hebrew, habet, actually means to look down. We're going to discuss that. Usfor hakochavim im tuchal lispor altam, and count the stars if you can count them. Vayomer, and he, capital H, said, lo, to him, ko yezarecha, this will be your seed. Who caught the English problem?
Should be like a semicolon and something following it. It doesn't stand by itself after the comma.
Well, the punctuation in the English, we can't judge the Hebrew based on the English punctuation. But what's redundant here? And he said, capital H. And he said, capital H. There's nothing else in between. It's the same person speaking. So this is one of two things. It's actually both, which I really like. So one way to understand this, and I learned this from Nechama Leibowitz, is stage direction. So God said, look heavenward and count the stars. And then this repetition of, and he said, means that there was an actual pause where Avram had to take the action of counting the stars. So another place where we see this, you can look it up, it's Shmot Perek Gimel, when, Dalit, when Moshe's at the burning bush and Hashem says, take off your shoes. And then it says, and he said again, without anything in between, he starts his introduction. And so that's the stage direction. Moshe, take off your shoes, because there's this repetition implying a pause of time. The other way, in a deeper way to understand it, and they're both correct, is that when there's this double vayomer of the same person speaking, it's implying that there's a whole dialogue that was left out of the Torah. And this is the source in the Torah for some of the midrashim that we have that you can think of as coming down on Har Sinai as the Torah Shebaal Peh at the same time as the written law. It's the filling in the blanks. What was the bigger conversation going on there? What are we missing? And so that double vayomer is your signal you are missing something. Something was edited out here for the sake of space. Because if we had everything in the Torah that happened, it would fill the universe, right? We wouldn't have enough room for it. So this is our hint that there's something deeper going on here. So Rashi brings it in a little bit. So first,
Excuse me, Stacey, you said that the word meant looking down.
Yeah.
Thank you, please look heavenward.
Yeah, we're going to see. We're going to see that. Okay, so Vayotzei oto achutza, you brought him outside. I'll read the English. According to its simple meaning, he took him out of his tent outdoors to see the stars. Again, it didn't say where he took him out. But according to his midrashic interpretation, he said to him, go out of your astrology, for you have seen in the signs of the zodiac that you are not destined to have a son. Indeed, Avram will have no son, but Avraham will have a son. Similarly, Sarai will not give birth, but Sarah will give birth. I will give you another name, and your destiny will change. Another explanation, he took him out of the terrestrial sphere and lifted him above the stars. This explains the expression of habata, looking down from above. Okay? So I kind of take those things and combine them in my understanding that what is happening here is so transformative from this moment on to humanity. This isn't just about the Jewish people. This is about what we call, that I usually don't like, but in this case it's true, the Judeo-Christian tradition. And what is this? Hashem is telling you, Avraham, you think that you're locked in this world of fate, which in the ancient world was represented by the stars. And the whole Greek mentality that the world was never created, that it was eternal, and that there's this cycle of repetition. Everything repeats, and it's just a circle. Did you, did anyone see the play Hadestown? So it's based on Greek mythology of Persephone and spring and winter and Hades and all these things. And it's really a tragic story. And at the end, they start over. Like the play starts from the beginning, and the narrator says they think it's going to be better. They think they can change the ending. But that's Greek philosophy. They can't. They're stuck in this fate that Avram thinks he's stuck in. And Hashem lifts him out of the world of fate, the art of the world of astrology, of people who think that they can't get out of whatever their life circumstances are, the circumstances of their birth, whatever it is, they think they're stuck. Hashem is saying, Avram, no, you have a destiny. And this is the beginning of the Jewish people, that Avram was willing to buy into the system of destiny, of trusting Hashem and recognizing, and this is where it goes from a circle to a spiral, that there is change and there is development and there is evolution. That sounded controversial. I didn't mean it that way. Okay, so the Gemara picks up on this, and it's a whole discussion. It was stated that Rabbi Chanina says, a constellation makes one wise and a constellation makes one wealthy. So that sounds exactly the opposite of what I just said. You are defined by the circumstances of your birth. Whatever month you were born in, that's going to define who you are. But then he says, and there is a constellation for the Jewish people that influences them. That's Rabbi Chanina. Rabbi Yochanan said, there is no constellation for the Jewish people that influences them. The Jewish people are not subject to the influence of astrology. And Rabbi Yochanan follows his own reasoning, as Rabbi Yochanan said, from where is it derived that there is no constellation for the Jewish people? As it is said, thus said the Lord, learn not the way of the nations, and be not dismayed at the signs of heaven, for the nations are dismayed at them. The nations will be dismayed by them, but not the Jewish people. And Rav also holds that there is no consolation for the Jewish people, as Rav Yehuda said, that Rav said, from where is it derived that there is no consolation for the Jewish people? As it is stated with regard to Avraham, and he brought him outside, and he said, look now toward heaven and count the stars if you are able to count them. And he said to him, unto him, so shall your offspring be. The sages derived from this that Avraham said before the Holy One, and here's that missing dialogue that Rashi also brought, but you can see in the double Vayomer, the double and he, capital H, said, Avram said before the Holy One, blessed be he, master of the universe, behold, you have given me no offspring, and one born in my house is to be my heir. And that's Genesis, Bereshit Tetvav Gimel. The Holy One, blessed be he, said to him, no. And behold, the word of the Lord came down to him, saying, this man shall not be your heir. Rather, one that will come forth from your own inner shall be your heir. Avram said before, master of the universe, I looked at my astrological map. I looked at my fate. And according to the configuration of my constellations, I'm not fit to have a son. The Holy One, blessed be he, said to him, emerge from your astrology, vayotze, take it out of it. As the verse states, he brought him outside, as there is no consolation for Israel. We'll maybe have a discussion of how the other rabbis could think that there was a consolation. Hopefully we'll be able to talk about that. So then, in that same brit, where Hashem says, don't worry, you're going to have children, he also informs him of what's going to happen to those children. And he says, no, that they're going to be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and they will enslave them and oppress them for 400 years. So the Gemara there says that So we're going to compare, if you see I bolded, strangers, land not theirs, enslave, and oppress. And I also bolded in the Hebrew, but they're all together, so it's harder to see that it's four. The Gemara says that the Kli Yakar that we're going to see says that each of these four things is represented in the four languages of redemption that are in Moshe's famous speech to Bnei Israel before the onset of the 10 plagues. And the Talmud Yerushalmi says that those four languages of redemption correspond to the four cups that we drink on Pesach. So here's the famous speech that Moshe gave. And also I heard the moans of the children of Israel whom the Egyptians are holding in bondage, and I remembered my covenant. And that's covenant, I bolded it, it's because what we just read from Brit Bein HaBetzarim with Avraham. Therefore, say to the children of Israel, I am the Lord, I will take you out, so they're bolded in the Hebrew, Hotzeti, from under the burdens of the Egyptians, I will save you from their labor, so say Vehitzalti, I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and great judgments, and I will take you to me as a people, Vilakachti, and I will be a God to you, and you will know that I am the Lord your God who has brought you out of from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will bring you to the land concerning which I raised my hand to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I will give it to you as a heritage. I am the Lord. Now, does anybody check my math here? So don't count my covenant, but how many phrases did I bold outside of my covenant? Hotzeti, Hitzalti, Ga'alti.
Right. Because you're counting.
Yes. Yes, I will bring you Veheveti. So how many cups do we actually have at the Pesach Seder? Five.
Four.
Well, Kosh Eliyahu. Yes, Kosh Eliyahu. So please God, when we are officially all brought to the land in an official messianic capacity, we'll drink the Kosh Eliyahu. The Kosh Eliyahu is sitting there. Do we drink this now? We have the state of Israel. We don't know. It's Eliyahu will decide when the time comes. Okay. And then the Ramban. So right now it seems like I'm giving a Pesach share, right? But when did Vilakachti happen? Lakachti is actually a language. My students at Kohelet can tell you because they're learning in Gemara Masachet Kiddushin, which is about marriage. And lakachat is a language of getting married. So when did we essentially marry Hashem?
Har Sinai,
Shavuot. And Ramban indeed says, v'lakachti etchem li la'am, I will take you to me as a nation, b'voachem el Har Sinai, when I bring you to Har Sinai, v'tekablu ha-Torah, and you receive the Torah. So again, this is putting together these four languages of redemption is dependent on Pesach and Shavuot. They last all the way through Shavuot, Lakachti, when Hashem essentially marries us. And that's also where you get the freedom too. We're now within a structure of our own choosing. We accepted Hashem's authority over us. So we went freedom from the slavery of Egypt, and on Shavuot, we land at the freedom too. And this is a long Kli Akar that goes through and relates each of the stages said to Avraham about the stages of how they will be embedded in this strange land that's not theirs, and they'll be enslaved, and then they'll be tortured. And the Kli Akar relates each of the four languages of Geula to a release. So the first one, Hotzeti, and you can even see it in the Psukim, I will take you out from under the burdens. That's the end of the torture. I will save you from their labor. That's the end of the slavery. So torture and slavery are two different things. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and great judgments. That's the end of being in a land that is not theirs. And then the final one, strangers, you'll no longer be strangers when I take you, and you'll be my nation, and I'll be your God. So that is the Kli Akar. So now Moshe gives this amazing, impassioned, inspiring speech to Bnei Israel. And what's their response? Moshe spoke thus to the children of Israel, but they couldn't hear it. They couldn't hear Moshe because of their shortness of breath and because of their hard labor. They weren't there. They were still in this slave mentality. They couldn't imagine a better life for themselves. It just didn't exist. They're very much entrenched in this world of fate. Their time is not their own. Nothing's their own. They haven't been able to think for themselves. They can't do anything. They can't even hear these words that Moshe is telling them about their freedom. And this is why, again, Pesach and Shavuot are so connected, because we needed those 50 days in order to be able to understand that we were free from, but we needed a freedom too. And Rav Soloveitchik, he describes this beautifully, and I don't know if Isaiah Berlin was already talking about these concepts of negative and positive liberty before he wrote them down in the 60s, or if Rav Soloveitchik, this predates it and he actually came up with it first. I don't know. So this is from Rav Soloveitchik, Kol Dodi Dofek. It's also called Fate and Destiny in the newer edition. It was given as address at Yeshiva University on the occasion of Israel's Independence Day in 1956. It discusses God and the Holocaust and the importance of the modern state of Israel and the role of Zionism in American Orthodoxy. It's become a classic text of religious Zionist philosophy. So you may have heard about this, the five knocks that he talks about, that we can't miss this opportunity. And he talks about all of the miracles hidden. If you looked at it, you really could see revealed miracles of the state of Israel. The Jewish people had an army. There was the Baal Tshuva movement was beginning. The Catholics were completely reevaluating their relationship with the Jewish people. All of these things were happening, and Rav Soloveitchik gave this earnest address to these rabbis not to miss these signs, these knocks, based on Shir Shirim, the Song of Songs, where the beloved misses the knock of her lover because she says, "Oh, I'm in bed already and I've oiled my hands. They're too slippery. I'm not going to be able to answer." And by the time she gets up to answer, he's gone. And he's urging us, don't miss these knocks. It's a beautiful book. And in it, he explains the difference between fate and destiny. What is an existence of fate? It is an existence of duress. In the nature of against your will do you live. It is a factual existence, simply one line in a long chain of mechanical causality, devoid of significance, direction, and purpose, and subordinate to the forces of the environment into whose midst the individual is pushed, unconsulted by providence. It sounds like a slave to a certain extent. The eye of fate emerges as an object. As an object, man appears as acted upon and not as actor. You can't do anything to change your fate. You are an object. He is acted upon through his passive collision with the objective outside as one object confronting another. The eye of fate is hurled into a sealed dynamic that is always turned outwards. Man's existence is hollow, lacking inner content, substance, and independence. The eye of fate denies itself completely because the sense of selfhood and objectification cannot dwell in tandem. In short, the Eye of Fate asks a speculative metaphysical question about evil, and this question is not given to solution and has no answer. What he's saying here is the Man of Fate asks why. Why is this happening to me? And of course, there's no answer. And he discusses in the same book, Job, Eov, and what happened to him, and all. It's a great book. I highly recommend it. It's not long. So why is this happening? And now to destiny. In the second dimension of man's existence, destiny, the question of suffering, takes on new form. What is an existence of destiny? It is an active existence. When man confronts the environment into which he has been cast with an understanding of his uniqueness and value, freedom and capacity, without compromising his integrity and independence in his struggle with the outside world. The slogan of the Eye of Destiny is, against your will you are born and against your will you will die, but by your free will do you live. Man is born an object, dies as an object. We have no control over birth or death. But it is within his capability to live as a subject, as a creator and innovator who impresses his individual imprimatur on his life and breaks out of a life of instinctive automatic behavior into one of creative activity. According to Judaism, man's mission in this world is to turn fate into destiny, an existence that is passive and influenced into an existence that is active and influential, an existence of compulsion, perplexity, and speechlessness, which the Jews were at that point when Moshe gave his speech, into an existence full of will, vision, and initiative. The blessing of the Holy One to his creation fully defines man's role. Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it. Conquer the environment and subjugate it. If you do not rule over it, it will enslave you. Destiny bestows on man a new status in God's world. It bestows on man a royal crown, and thus he becomes God's partner in the work of creation. The question of questions is, what does suffering obligate man to do? Okay, so the man of fate asks why. Why is this happening? There's no answer. The man of destiny says, what's my role? What do I have to do? What can I do? What? We do not wonder about the ineffable ways of the Holy One, but instead ponder the paths man must take when evil leaps up at him. We ask not about the reason for evil and its purpose, but rather about its rectification and uplifting. How should a man react in a time of distress? What should a person do so as not to rot in his affliction? It's a totally different worldview, a totally different way of looking at life and your purpose in it. Not why, which is unanswerable and leads us to paralysis, but what can I do? How can I make this better? So that is our goal, I think, between Pesach and Shavuot, to utilize the Sfirat HaOmer, the counting of the Omer, to, in our own personal journey of freedom from where we were released from slavery, but we have no purpose, we don't know what to do, to freedom to the positive liberty, where we buy into this structure. And I didn't include these sources here, but the Ibn Ezra and the Meiri implies that anybody who buys into this structure that Hashem is giving over, that if you buy into the fact of destiny, to be a man of destiny, then you also exit out of the world of fate. And the Meiri explains it that anybody who buys into ethical monotheism, it doesn't have to be a Jew, anybody who buys into that worldview no longer has fate, the constellations on him, which implies, it goes along with the other rabbi, Rabbi Yochanan, I think it was, in the Gemara, that says Jews, B'nai Israel, does have a constellation. That's only if you don't buy in. If you don't buy into this, if you don't utilize this time between Pesach and Shavuot to realize what your destiny is, what your purpose is, then you have a constellation over you. You've just limited yourself. And that's what the difference between fate and destiny is, and that's what we do during this time of the year, that we really key into that, plug into that, and work on ourselves in that way and recognize what our destiny is. And I love this story, The Wedding Made by a Matzah in Bergen-Belsen. I'm going to read it to you. What the Blujever Rebbe went through during the Holocaust was mind-boggling. The Nazis murdered his wife, his only daughter, his entire family, almost all of his hundreds of Hasidim. After the war, it took a lot of courage for survivors to remarry. But after his liberation from Bergen-Belsen, somebody suggested a match to the Blujever Rebbe, a widow who had survived amazingly enough with her four children. and that woman named Branya became the Blizhever Rebbetzin. Years later, somebody asked the Rebbe how he knew, despite everything he had gone through, that he wanted to marry his Rebbetzin Branya. And the Blizhever Rebbe shared the following extraordinary story. At one point, when the Rebbe was in Bergen-Belsen, he went to the camp officials to request permission to bake matzahs. And unexpectedly, they responded, okay, but whoever wants to make the matzahs with you has to write down their name and will submit the request to Berlin. Most of the Jews, of course, didn't put their names down on the request because they figured writing their names was as good as writing their own obituaries. But the Rebbe said, look, we don't have anything to lose. We're going to die anyway. So the Rebbe and four other men wrote their names down on the request to make matzahs, and they submitted it. But right away, they regretted their decision. They feared the request was the same as calling out to the Nazis, hey there, please kill us. But a few weeks later, the camp officials returned and announced, okay, who are the five people who said they want to make matzahs? Come with us. So those five men, thinking those were their last moments on earth, said goodbye to their friends. But instead of killing them, the camp officials informed them that a request had been approved. So then the question was, who would get to eat from the matzahs? There were only a few small matzahs and tens of thousands of Jews in Bergen-Belsen. And then a mother of four children stepped forward and said, could you please break off small pieces of the matzah for my children? The other people there argued, but your children are still small. They aren't obligated yet to eat matzah. But she answered them, my children are the next generation. They have to know what matzah is. They are the future of the Jewish people. So the Rebbe gave them matzah. So this woman, Rebbetzin Branya, even in the midst of Bergen-Belsen, was able to buy into the system that Avraham was introduced to. She got out of her fate and she saw her destiny. So why did the Rebbe decide to marry that mother of four children after the war? The Rebbe later explained, nobody in Bergen-Belsen thought about the next minute. You didn't think about the next day, the next week. Survival was second to second. Freedom, they didn't have freedom from anything. They certainly weren't buying into the system. They were living a world of fate, a life of fate. And here's this woman who thinks she's going to survive, and that there's going to be the next, and that there's going to be a next generation. And I knew that if this woman had that kind of courage, if she was so connected with the story of Passover that she believed we would experience our own personal exodus from Bergen-Belsen, then that was the woman I would marry. The Rebbe and his Rebbetzin, who lived until 99 and 94, did not have any more children after the war. But the Rebbe raised Rebbetzin Branya's four children as his own, and the Blizhever Rebbes today are those children who ate matzah in Bergen-Belsen in the merit of their mother's astonishing determination and faith. So my advice to you all is to try to understand that that matzah that you ate however many weeks ago, the taste of that matzah should carry you through two Shavuot as we all are on this journey of destiny. And if you forgot about that matzah and you got stuck and you're not in a good place right now, well, guess what? Pesach Sheni is on Shabbos. So you have a second chance. Pesach is the only holiday that we have a second chance. And I'm glad that I checked this. I'm reminding myself, this Shabbos, Shabbos lunch, we should all take out our matzah. We should all eat it, and we should taste that freedom, taste that buying into our destiny and leaving our world of fate. So thank you very much, everybody.